All right, so just another announcement. I do make recordings of the class for those who have not been here before. Those are uploaded and then they're available on the podcast, on the media tab of the home church. And go down and it says Home Church Bible Class, and the audio recording will be there. Sometimes it takes 3 or 4 days, maybe toward the end of the week, before they get up there. So I don't have any control over some of that. But anyway, so that you could, if you miss a lesson, you can listen. And also, if you miss notes, you can get them from the email that I send out. All right. So our study is the book of Isaiah. And I went through dozens of thoughts of titles, and I came up with Isaiah. Judgment and Redemption. There's so many different ways. I looked at all kinds of different commentaries. They got all manner of different ways to do, to try to title this book. But I chose Judgment and Redemption as kind of a subtitle because we do see a lot of judgment, and we've got to figure that in. And that's going to be part of what we're going to be looking at, because a lot of the book of Isaiah is judgment. And so how do we deal with that as the church, as believers in the part of the new covenant? We're not under the law. We're not the nation of Israel. We're not Babylonians. We are not, you know, from all these other nations that God judged. But what can we get from that idea of judgment? What are we going to be able to pull out of that? So we'll look at that. Of course, then the promise of redemption. And it seems like over and over in this book, you move from God's judgment to a promise of redemption. And sometimes as this promise of redemption is like almost right there in the middle of something about judgment, or it hangs on. Or there's a subject about redemption, and then there's also this warning of judgment. So it goes back and forth between these two things, as we will see as we go just page through the lesson. So this study is not going to be verse by verse, line upon line. All right? Because 66 books. I'm not sure. I didn't count the number of verses. Somebody will probably, because Sarah will probably know by the end of our class time tonight how many verses are here. But there's a lot in here. And it's not necessary that we need to see every verse and every word, but there's truth in all of this. And we will pull out some specific things. This is the sacred scrolls. Isaiah is considered one of the sacred scrolls, and it is one of the most complete scrolls that we have, is stored in, you know, Bible museums. I think it's a place in Israel. I can't remember the name of it, the Temple of Scriptures. But anyway, so they have manuscripts from Isaiah that date back to 400 years before Christ. So there are some, right, not the complete scroll, but parts of it. And the parts that they have are fully in agreement with the scrolls that they have that are reserved from the first century. So we have the book of Isaiah as it was presented. And this is an important principle. This is the second most quoted book in the New Testament. Psalms is the first, but the second most is Isaiah. Then would come Deuteronomy. So it was used a lot in the New Testament era. This is what they knew. This was their Bible. It's the Bible that Jesus referred to. These were the scrolls that they had. In the first century church, they didn't have what we consider the New Testament. It was being written and it was being collected, but some people had it, some people didn't. Some had some parts of this verses, some had some parts of the letters, but as far as a Bible, that wasn't fully collected and bound until the 400s in, you know, AD. So this was the scrolls that they used. This is what Peter preached from, and Paul, and we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. So you look at your note there, Isaiah is quoted or alluded to. Sometimes it's not a direct quotation. It's like a paraphrase or a reminder of, but 62 times in the New Testament, 21 times in the Gospels. So it was Jesus used this a lot, so also did the writers of the Gospels. 25 times in Paul's letters. So he liked using this letter, this book. It's 6 times in the book of 1 Peter, 5 times in Acts, 4 times in Revelation, and once in the book of Hebrews. That doesn't mean that those are the only references, because sometimes what's there was also expressed in Isaiah, but it's not just a direct quotation. So we have all of that material for us to refer to. We're going to look at this by section. So I've got that divided here. We'll look at that in just a minute. Sometimes we'll look at in depth at certain chapters. Others sometimes we'll pass over a chapter or summarize chapters because sometimes they say pretty much the same that God has said before. But there are also important principles in each one of these. So we'll sort that out. And then some chapters we will go literally verse by verse. And there are some very important chapters in the book of Isaiah that refer to us in the New Testament and to the work of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, as a Redeemer. So we'll look more detailed at some chapters, but not at every one, or we would be here till Jesus comes back if he doesn't come back in the next 5 years. So as we look at this this book, this kind of an outline track that I'm going to follow. I'm not calling it necessarily an outline, but it's the track that we're going to be looking at as we kind of break down the book into some sections, into certain expressions that several chapters may fit in, certain emphasis that is in those chapters. So the first 5 chapters is Isaiah's vision of the Lord's indictment of Judah and Jerusalem. And it's almost like a court scene where God calls them to the bench. And God says, come here, I'm going to talk to you. And God is very bold in some of the things that he says, some in reference to the northern tribes of Israel, to their rebellion, some to the tribe of Judah, some directly to the city of Jerusalem, to the believers, some to the priests. And so he's calling them all, in a sense, to the bench. And he says, we got to talk because you're doing this wrong. And so there's a lot that he wants to emphasize in those first chapters. Then, of course, chapter 6 is that great, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. And so this is the chapter of Isaiah's vision and prophetic call. Now, it's like, why isn't that at the beginning? I don't know. You can talk to Isaiah when you get to heaven. But this order is as it was laid out in the most ancient references that we have. It's not been moved around. It's not been collected in different places. So whatever Isaiah started with those first 5 chapters, and then he began mentioning his prophetic call. It doesn't mean that those first 5 chapters happened before he was called. He was called, and then God began to speak to him, but he arranged those first 5 chapters with that. We'll talk more about that as we come to it. Then in chapters 7 through 12, we see as a collection. Now, this is not hard line because there's you know, soft definitions of each one of these, soft borders, if you want to think of it that way. But chapter 7 through 12 talk about God's signs of judgment and the promise of deliverance. So over and over, he talks about judgment, deliverance. Judgment, deliverance. Judgment, redemption. So God goes back and forth with those things. And sometimes it's like, man, this is a heavy chapter. And then all of a sudden it breaks into a promise of redemption. So God never makes judgment without referring to his promise. And his promise was the first thing he gave all the way back at creation. His promise came first. And then comes all the violation. But God has what? A promise. And he's what? Faithful. And so if he made a promise, he's faithful to fulfill it. And he will come back to those things. Then chapters 13 through 23, the Lord's righteous judgment on the nations. Now some of these are nations that don't even exist. How's that for judgment? They're not even around. You can't even find record of them except the Bible. We may find some evidence in other writings that these nations existed, but there's no archaeology, there's no writings from them, there's nobody that identifies himself as an Edomite. They're gone. These different nations are just gone. And that doesn't mean, does that mean God couldn't redeem some people out of there? Of course not. He did, and he will. So, the Lord's judgment. Then comes chapters 24 through 27, and it's a proclamation of God's ultimate victory over the nations. I don't care what the world looks like. I don't care what it seems like. It doesn't matter how big these nations are, how overwhelming they seem to be, how terrorizing they might be. God is ultimately victorious over them. And, you know, I still go back to a phrase that Brother Hagin used to use, hide and watch. You know, it's going to happen. You know, just wait for it. Because it will come. Then he talks in chapters 28 through 33, the false hope of placing trust in the strength of nations. If you're trusting in these nations, you're trusting in their gods, which, in a sense, the nation is identified with their gods. And so these nations had their own kind of personal gods. And one of the things that we'll look at is when Sennacherib conquered so much of the Middle East and destroyed what we know of as the northern nation of Israel, Syria, all the rest of the Assyrian Empire. As he conquered these ones, he came to Jerusalem. He says, you know what? Nobody else's gods have been able to stop me. So what do you think? What makes you think your God can? He did. And so there, the nations identified themselves with these pagan gods. And they were, you know, known by that God. The God was known by the nation. So, but God has his ultimate plan for those. Chapters 34 and 35, the Lord's victory over his enemies and a promise of redemption. He begins listing different enemies but redemption. There will be redemption. There will be redemption. For who? Redemption for those who trust in him, those who believe in him, those who accept him as Lord of all. Then we get a little bit of reprieve, kind of, sort of, in chapters 36 through 39, which we have the account of King Hezekiah. And some of this matches what's in the book of First Chronicles. Some of it matches what's in Second Kings. So it's kind of a back and forth of what's going on. Some of the things Isaiah says fill in some spaces in the accounts in Kings and Chronicles about the King Hezekiah. And we see, you know, we always talk about Hezekiah being the most faithful, most perfect king. Yeah, but God's not afraid to list his failures. Now, I'm believing that when I get to heaven, there's going to be all the great things that Jeff did. Scrolls full of it. And none of the bad stuff. So, you know, I got a reason to believe it that way, because you get the book of Hebrews. All you see in Hebrews is all the good things that Abraham did. Jacob's mentioned there. You know what it says about him? What good thing he did? He blessed his sons leaning on his staff. That's it. Of all the things that Jacob could do to be honored in the hall of faith, it's he leaned on his staff and blessed his sons. Okay, that's easy. Yep, I could do that. Samson's mentioned in there. Yeah, so, but none of his bad. And I believe that's kind of a message to us, that of the life that we live, it's what we did for the Lord that is remembered. What we did by faith, which is basically the title line of Hebrews chapter 11, what we did by faith. And those are the things that honor the Lord, and those are the things that will be remembered. Then we come back to the great chapters of redemption. And we make this turn in the book of Isaiah, starting in chapter 40. We call this the post-redemptive passages, because God starts out with that beautiful passage, Comfort ye, my people. Say to Jerusalem. And so God's promise, he said he would deliver them, and he would. Even though they were in captivity because of their sin and rebellion, God said, I'm going to redeem you. And so we rejoice in that, because those are the great promises of redemption. If you look up above, I kind of skipped over this one mention, but not only is this the longest book, it's like the third bullet point down, 66 chapters in the book of Isaiah, just like there's 66 books in the Bible. 39 of the chapters are pre-redemptive, just like 39 books in the Old Testament. 27 of the books are post-redemptive, just like the 27 books in the New Testament. Now, the Bible guys didn't put that together that way. God did. And he ordered those things so that would be a plan. It's a pathway. And so when we look at the book of Isaiah, it's almost immediate. It's like crossing a line where there's a shadow. You're in the darkness, and all of a sudden you're in the light. Now, that doesn't mean in the last 27 chapters of Isaiah there's not judgment, because there is. But the theme totally changes. It's about God redeeming his people and his faithfulness and what he's going to do to redeem, and how the nations cannot resist what he wants to do. So breaking that down further, chapters 40 through 66, the first section, chapter 46 through 48, is God's humiliation of the gods of Babylon. He's done with them. And you know, we get to the book Revelation, and God's done with the prostitute of Babylon. He's done with the city of Babylon. He's done with all those people. And you look in Revelation chapter 17 and 18, and it is God, I'm done with all of this. It's the end of the tribulation. They're done. And God has come to an end, and he's going to pronounce those ends in those three chapters, 46 through 48. And then come God's proclamation of his promised redemption and restoration. So beautiful chapters, Isaiah 49 through 55, these beautiful chapters of what God is going to do to restore his people, how he's going to bring them back, how he's going to make them fruitful, how he's going to bring them forth. And he's going to cause them to prosper. He's going to cause them to be blessed. And he's going to cause their name to be great again. And so God is over and over pronouncing in those chapters those things. Then he comes back to chapters 56 through 59. The failure of Israel to overcome. The failure of Israel is overcome by the faithfulness of the Lord. So we get in this passage just like we do in some of David's Psalms. The people did this, but God did this. The people did this, but God was faithful. The people did this, but God was faithful. And we see that over and over in these chapters, 56 through 59. And then, of course, chapters 60 through 66 is our great judge. He is our great judge and our glorious redeemer. And we see these beautiful chapters, what God has promised he's going to do for his people. So, in introducing this, my title for this this lesson is called It's Complicated. Do you ever have somebody, you know, start telling you something and they start down the line and they say, well, it's complicated. You know, and if you want to tell the story of your life, you might start on and you just say, well, it's complicated. How did you get back together? Well, it's complicated. So that's what we see here in the book of Isaiah. There's complicated things here. And sorting them out, I'm not saying I am the master of all of this. I'm not. I've read numerous commentaries on this, trying to grasp some of these truths, but there's still things here. And especially among the New Testament believers, for the most part, they don't like the Old Testament, and they especially don't like the prophets. Mostly they don't like the book of Leviticus, but but they have problems. Why am I studying this? Why am I studying these? I don't know who these people are. These nations don't exist anymore. Why is this important to me? And so a lot of people look at the Old Testament in that way. And so your assignment is to read the book of Isaiah. You know, you got like four different days in your reading, you know, to read the book of Isaiah. Hopefully it's more than that. And you think, halfway through, it's like you're zoned over. I know I'm reading the verses, but it's not meaning anything to me. I'm reading words, and they're just going over my head. Come on, how many of you have done that? You can't even remember what the last verse was that you read. You know, and that's just been 10 seconds ago. And yes, I read it. Really? Really? Yeah. Did you? And so there's all these things. It's like, why am I doing this? And we see all these things about judgment, 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 judgment. It's like, aren't we free from the law? Aren't we? Somebody say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we're free from the law, but why am I reading this? What's that got to do with me? And that's the way a lot of people look at much of the Old Testament. There are pastors, preachers, who will not deal with anything in the Old Testament. They will preach anything out of the Old Testament. Maybe the Psalms. Maybe a couple verses out of Genesis. Maybe. But as far as a study of some of these books, a presentation, you know, I've used this before, but you're going to get to heaven and Habakkuk's going to come up to you and say, hey, did you read my book? And you say, what book? I didn't know you wrote a book. So we need to pay attention to these things. And I know that we're going to be looking at things, and it's like, I don't know who these... Okay, first of all, there's not going to be a test. You're not going to have to remember who these people are or what years they existed. We're going to talk about a little bit of history next week. So, I shouldn't have told you, but... So we're going to be looking, because you've got to place some things. My first year to teach at Rhema, 1979, I was given to teach the second year students. It was the first year that they had a second year class. Does that make sense? So the first time they had a second year class, so I was given to teach the book of Isaiah. Dr. Ken Stewart assigned me that. I'm not sure he's my friend anymore, but. So I go up there the first, four different groups of second year students that I was going to have. And so my first round of the students, I got up there and I said, okay, we're going to study the book of Isaiah. And I began doing a little bit of overview of Isaiah, you know, the southern kingdom. He was a prophet to Judah and Jerusalem. And I saw people's eyes like, what? What are you talking about? And so I started asking them questions. Have you studied, you know, like the northern and southern kingdoms? And they say, what? Northern kingdom Israel, southern kingdom Judah. It's like, aren't they all the same thing? You know, and these different stories of the Old Testament and the history of the kings and the empires. It's like, no. I said, well, who taught you Old Testament survey? And they said, there wasn't one. Oh, great. So now I'm supposed to teach the book of Isaiah to people who've never even been introduced to the survey of the Old Testament, what the history is, who these people were, what was the track of what's going on. So I had to take the first, like, six sessions of my series just to go back and help them to recover some of the history. All right, I'm not going to spend that much time with you because you're all informed. But we are going to do some review. Because we've got to, in order to understand some of the prophetic words and what God's emphasis is that he's speaking through Isaiah, we've got to understand who he's talking to and what's going on. And so there's a lot that we will be looking at and drawing from. And so we'll start next week. We're going to talk about who Isaiah was, when he lived, the different kings and the different nations that were in authority during that period of time, so that we can more fully appreciate the words that are coming forth. Okay? So, we'll be doing that. And the question asked is, why are we studying this? Well, here we go. Point number one. The Old Testament books were the scriptures that Jesus learned as he was growing, and the ones from which he taught as he ministered. That was his Bible, if we want to say. He taught from the Old Testament scriptures. That's what the people knew. Sometimes all they knew was the laws of the Pharisees, which some of them aren't even in the Bible. Many of them are not in the Bible. But they didn't know that because nobody taught them the scriptures. So the Pharisees could come along and the Sadducees and tell them this and tell them they had to do this and they had to do that. God never said that they had to. But they would put these things out there and bring condemnation upon the people. Jesus came to present the gospel. From the very announcing of Jesus, he was going to present the gospel, the good news. And what is this good news? Well, number one, it's not what the Pharisees were saying. So it's not the judgment and all those things that were going to come from that. So Jesus taught from these scriptures. I don't want to oversimplify things. The Pharisees did teach many good things, and there are people that did learn. Jesus went to rabbinical school. He studied under different ones of the Jewish rabbis. He was studying under the temple. Pastor Jeff just went through that. Interesting thing about that is that passage that talks about Jesus being in the temple. It says he was asking questions that they couldn't answer. So they would say, okay, we're going to read today. We're going to read Isaiah 53. And he's going through there and he says, so who is this servant? I don't know, kid. Shut up. You're bothering me. You know, it's like, I don't know. And their interpretation of the servant of God was Israel. Israel is the servant, and we've been beaten, and we've been chastised, and we've suffered and all these things, but we're going to deliver the nation. No, the servant is someone who's going to die for you. He's not you. So anyway, so Jesus was asking questions they couldn't answer, then he'd answer them. Well, that wouldn't embarrass you, you know, a 12-year-old, you know. So they were probably saying, would his mother please come and take him out of here? So maybe it was their prayers that caused Mary to realize that Jesus was with him. Would you get him back there? Anyway, so the very habit of Jesus was not just to teach the scriptures. He taught from them. And so as you read through the Gospels, he doesn't just quote this verse and quote that verse and go from here and go from there, but he taught from them. He taught the lessons that were bound up in the Old Testament, many times uncovering things that God had expressed, but that they weren't hearing. So we look at that. Luke chapter 4, verse 18, of course, is very very familiar with you, but we start in verse 17. Luke 4, 17, it says, "And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him." So in a cabinet in the synagogue was this cabinet, and in it had these different cubicles. And in each one of these little, like we think of like a pigeonhole, you know, each one of those, they would pull out a scroll. Now, according to some people, that Isaiah was four scrolls, as it was so long. Others of the books were just one scroll. But he pulled out the scroll of Isaiah, was given to him. So that was the rabbi's choice. Well, here, let's give him this one to read from. Boy, was that the right choice for Jesus, but the wrong choice for him. So he pulled out the scroll of Isaiah, and Jesus found the place where it was written. It's not necessarily that he said, read here. The speaker, whoever was recognized as a speaker of synagogue, had a right to choose in the scroll what verses he wanted to minister. So he found where it was written. And he read, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." That came from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. And so Jesus found that passage and he read it. And as he came to the end of that, he stopped before it goes into the pronouncement of judgment. He stops because that's as far as he wanted to go right now. In his first coming, it's all about down to here. The second coming, it will be about the other part of this, the judgment that's going to follow. But he stopped and he turned to the people and he said, "This day has been fulfilled in your ears. I am the me." And so he was pronouncing this, and of course, that caused all the Pharisees to rejoice. They were jumping up and down. This is like the greatest thing. We're so happy you're here. No, it didn't go that way, did it? And they ultimately, they wanted to just put him to death right there. So, but Jesus found the place that was referring to him. And there's plenty of places in the book of Isaiah that refer to Jesus. And many of those things we will uncover as we go through. All right. Then Matthew chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. Jesus had ministered at the synagogue. Man was healed. He went down the street to Peter's mother-in-law's house, so Peter's wife's home, and went down there, and the mother-in-law was sick. So Jesus went in, prayed for her. She got better, and she went and fixed him dinner. That's pretty cool. And so all of this was gathering attention of the people. What happened in the synagogue was enough, but now this was happening. And so this huge crowd of people began to press upon him. And one of the most beautiful things I've ever read was Charles Spurgeon's his comment on this gathering of people that was there. And it's almost overwhelming. So maybe if you have a Spurgeon Bible or one of his commentaries, you could read that. I know some of you want me to do it now. I shouldn't have brought it up, but I did. But I don't have it in front of me, and I can't quote it. And so all this gathering of people was there. And what did Jesus do? He began healing. And he healed them all, cast out demons, set people free. It was a glorious time. How late in the night that must have gone, we got no idea. multitudes of these people just gathered, and he healed them all. And Matthew's commentary on this is stated in verses 16 and 17. So that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word, healed all who were sick. Verse 17, this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Now there are preachers, theologians, who say, well, Matthew was, the passage in Isaiah 53, verse 4, is talking about sin and the oppression of sin and how he's going to relieve all our oppression of sin. It's not talking about sickness and disease. Well, no, because Matthew, who's writing by the inspiration of God, says this was to fulfill the sicknesses and diseases that were mentioned in Isaiah. So it is about healing, whether they believe in it or not. That's what it was about. And how is that refuted? How is that presented? By quoting from a passage in the book of Isaiah. This he said to fulfill the words of Isaiah. So again, not only did Jesus teach from, he lived these passages from Isaiah. And so, again, it's Isaiah's mention that is brought up here. Look at the passage in Luke 24, about the middle of your page. Luke 24, verse 44. This is at the end of Jesus' ministry. He's in the grave. He rose from the dead. And now he's appeared with his disciples. He was with them over a period of 40 days, going in and out, the scripture says, and talking with them about the things concerning the kingdom. But one of the things he was doing, look at this, Luke 24, verse 44, and he said to them, these are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me. Now, Jesus didn't go back and find things and say, oh, okay, I'm supposed to do this. Oh, and okay, I'm supposed to do this. And over here, I'm supposed to do this. He didn't do that. He just did it, and it fulfilled what was written 3,000 years before. And so he was living out those things even as God had said it would be done. It was done. And he says, these things that were written about me in the law of Moses, in the prophets and the Psalms, and they all must be fulfilled. And so I have done all these things that it said that I would be doing. Then he opened their minds to understand. So after he had said all of that, they're standing there, as Brother Hagin used to say, like a cow looking at a new gate, you know, or a dog looking at a new pan or whatever. And it's like, they got eyes glazed over, and it's like, what? And he began to explain to them. Can you imagine that? Listening to Jesus explain all these Old Testament prophecies. And so we think that Jesus was only with his disciples for two or three times after his resurrection. But Acts chapter 1 says he went in and out with them 40 days explaining things concerning the kingdom. So he was with them a lot. But now their minds are opened and they began to understand and perceive things. So Jesus came to do this. And so this is how he was fulfilling. And then he said at the end, thus it is written, the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance for forgiveness of sin should be proclaimed in his name to all nations. Where's that quoted? Where's that from? The Old Testament. All those things. In other words, you can find that the Christ should suffer, the Messiah would suffer. You can find that in the Old Testament. You can find it in the book of Isaiah. And on the third day, he'd rise from the dead. You can find that in the Old Testament. You can find it in the book of Isaiah. And that repentance should be, for forgiveness of sin, should be proclaimed to all nations, not just to the Jews. You know where you can find that? In the Bible, Old Testament, and in the book of Isaiah. So we'll look at some of these things as how it came to pass. So, is studying the Old Testament important? Yes. Because this is where the root of what we're believing is. The root of our redemption, the purpose and the plan of everything that God did in redeeming us is declared there. And so these are the promises that have been made within the scriptures. Next point. This is one of the books Peter and Paul used when preaching the gospel of salvation. First to the Jews, then to the Gentiles. So Isaiah was one of the books that they used. Other New Testament books, other Old Testament books were used by Peter and Paul. For example, on the day of Pentecost, Peter quoted from the book of Joel. Now, that wasn't just because he was reading his morning devotions and the book of Joel, you know, happened to be where he was supposed to read that day. No, Jesus did what during those 40 days? He was in and out with them explaining the case concerning the kingdom, and he opened their understanding so that when Peter saw what was taking place, he openly quoted from the book of Joel. Peter was not a rabbi, not a theologian. He was a what?
Fisherman.
How does he know Joel chapter 2? By the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God led him to this. Obviously, Jesus must have spoken about this. There's things that were uncovered, and Peter just began to speak, and he said, this is it. This is what it said in the book of Joel. And so he begins to minister that. And so he says, in the last days, God declares that I will pour out my Spirit upon all flesh. He said, this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. So these Old Testament passages are foundations for what we realize in the New Testament, in our redemption, in the life that God has given us, in the blessings in which we walk, in the purposes, the plans that God has for us in our life. The roots for all of those are in the Old Testament. And we can find those then expressed in this life. Look at the bottom of your page, Acts chapter 17, verses 2 and 3. And this is when Peter had gone to Greece. Then when he was basically thrown out of Greece, he went to the town of Thessalonica. And then he went from there to Berea, and from there to Athens, and from there to Corinth. And so each one of these places. But one of the things it says is the first thing Paul did is he went to the synagogues. And he would go in there, and because he was a rabbi, and they knew he'd been trained in Jerusalem under Gamaliel, they were welcoming him to come and speak to us. You know, just, you ask for it, you're going to get it. And so they asked him to come and speak, and he would do so. But what did he do? Look at how he did. This is what he did when he came into their synagogues. He reasoned with them from the scriptures. The word reason means to ask questions and answer them. Exactly what Jesus did in the temple. Ask a question. And the Greek word is dialogomai, which we think dialogue means between two people. But to the rabbis of the day, after he actually goes back to Socrates, was to ask questions and answer it. That the purpose of that is the teacher sets up the answer. I ask you a question because I know what I'm going to answer it with. And I'm not asking so you can tell me. I'm asking so I can tell you. And that's what Jesus would do. But notice what it says. He asked the questions and answered them what? What's it say? From the scriptures. So he would go to their Old Testament. Unroll your scrolls. Look at what it says. And he would take them to these passages. It's like, who is the servant that's spoken of in Isaiah 53? Who is the one who is promised to come? Who is the one who would be sacrificed and die for your sins? Who is this one? The Messiah. He's the Christ. And so he'd answer their questions. And then he would go on after answering the questions from the scriptures. Then he would explain and prove. He would open up their minds. The word explain means to open the mind. And then he would prove. He would take this verse and this verse and this verse and this passage, maybe sometimes an allegory like Jesus would do, and explain these things and prove that what he's talking about is about who? Proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead. You didn't think that was in there. You didn't think the Messiah was going to suffer and die and rise from the dead. You didn't think that. Why? Because nobody told you. But it's in the scriptures, and he showed it to them. And out of this, many of the Jews believed. This is what they've been waiting for. A Messiah. Not all the Jews were antagonistic against the message. Many of them opened their hearts and believed. But so also did a lot of these Gentiles who were standing on the outside, in a sense, of the temple, sometimes around the perimeter, but many times outside. And they would hear this message, and they heard what Paul was saying and how he explained all this, and they, with one voice, they came and said, "What do we do to be saved?" And so that's what takes place. How the Christ must suffer and rise from the dead. And you want to know who the Messiah is? You want to know his name? This Jesus that I preach is that Messiah. So I'm going to not only tell you that the Messiah was coming and the Messiah has come, I'm going to tell you his name. Jesus, the one I've been talking about. And multitudes came to salvation. Some men shut their hearts. And they closed themselves off from this message. But Paul did this. He used the Old Testament scriptures to lead people to these principles, that the promised Messiah, the Christ, would suffer, die, raise from the dead, and that the one who did that is Jesus of Nazareth. All right, go to the top of your next page. More than any other, Isaiah was used by Paul. Now, these are not all of Paul's quotations. You can check those out if you have Google. Just Google and find all of the quotations of the Old Testament that were in the books of Paul. So you can find those. But Paul used Isaiah and other books of the Old Testament to explain and support the message of salvation. For example, Acts chapter 13, verse 38. "Let it be known to you, therefore, brothers, that through this man forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you." This is at the church or the synagogue in Antioch that is in what we know of as Turkey. And so he said that through this man, this Jesus, this Messiah I've been telling you about, is forgiveness of sins. Verse 39, "And by him, everyone who believes." I love this. This is one of my most favorite. I know we got lots of my favorites, but this is one of my favorite passages that is here. "Everyone who believes is freed." Check this out. "Freed from everything from which you could not be freed by the law of Moses." Wow. Is that beautiful? Wow. That's just one of those, Paul, that's so beautiful that you would say that. That through this Jesus, you are set free from all the things that the law could not set you free from. Beautiful. Verse 40. "Beware, therefore, lest what is said in the prophets," all right, "should come about." Open your eyes. Now, the word beware isn't like danger. It means look. Look, that's what is said should come about. "Look, you scoffers, be astounded and perish. For I'm doing a work in your days, a work that you would not believe even if one tells it to you." Habakkuk said, God is going to reveal something that you wouldn't believe even if he told you. And you know what? Habakkuk didn't tell him. Why? Because God said what? You wouldn't believe it if I told you. So I'm not going to. And so he kind of leaves that hanging until he gets to the next chapter and he talks about the watchman on the wall and seeing the things that God is going to do and write it down. Now, that quotation is from the book of Habakkuk. But it's also referred to in Isaiah. Isaiah followed Habakkuk. And so Habakkuk had said that. Paul makes kind of an allusion to that. He doesn't quote it. He doesn't refer right back to it. But he says some things that go along exactly with that. It's almost like a paraphrase. And so Paul's saying, you know, I'm telling you these things because this is the Messiah that's going to set you free. Then within those passages, Acts 13, verse 47, it says, "For so the Lord has commanded us, saying." So as Paul's proclaiming this message to the Jews, he said, "The Lord has also commanded us, saying, I have made you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring salvation to the ends of the earth." That's first of all a reference to Jesus. It's second of all a reference to those who preach his name. Jesus is a light to the Gentiles, but so also is the message we proclaim. It's a light to the Gentiles. It was never meant just for the Jews. It was never meant just for this one group of people who would be saved and everybody else go to hell. No, it was meant for all the nations. But it was going to come through the Jews. But later on in that chapter it says, but they consider themselves, listen to this phrase, they consider themselves unworthy of salvation. They consider themselves unworthy of this grace. So Paul said, so I'm going to leave the synagogue and I'm going to the Gentiles. And he did. So this is one of those things. And where did he quote that from? Isaiah 49. Then we come over to the book of Romans, chapter 10, verse 15. And it says, and how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written. You know this verse. But what does he say? As it is written. So this passage, as it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. Isaiah 52, verse 7. So Paul, again, using this to substantiate the necessity of preaching this gospel to those who need to hear. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9. Paul says, but as it is written. Written where? Isaiah 64, verse 4. What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. No one has come to this understanding of what God has prepared for those who love him. What has he prepared for us? Salvation. And in that, wrapped in salvation, is everything that we could possibly need.
Amen.
This message of salvation. Then 1 Corinthians 15. Quoting from Isaiah 25, verse 8. Paul says, when the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, Isaiah 25, verse 8, death is swallowed up in victory. And we know that phrase, but it comes from the book of Isaiah. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 2. For he says, this is God says, in a favorable time, I listened to you. And in a day of salvation, I have helped you. Behold, now is the favorable time. Now is the day of salvation. So Paul writes that to them saying, this is it. Don't pass this up. Don't pass it up. You don't know tomorrow. So if you will not open your heart today, this is the favorable time. This is the day of salvation. Why? Because it was presented to you. This is the day you heard it. Don't walk away like I did. When I was sixth grade, went to a Billy Graham crusade in Columbus, Ohio. And I sat there and cried. But because of my denominational upbringing, I was not going to walk down those stairs and go on that field. I knew there was something in there that was pulling at me. It pulled on me so hard that there I was crying in the stadium, but I wouldn't go. Thank God I didn't die in between then and when I was 22 years old. God preserved my life, but it doesn't always happen that way. There are people who have heard who have not yielded. The favorable time is when you hear it. The day of salvation is the day you hear it. Now is that day. So, I'll cover the rest of this next week. So, Isaiah is used to substantiate so many of these doctrines, so many of these principles. And there's so many other things we're going to pull out as we go through this book, looking at God's promise of salvation. We're going to see out of all these things, especially sometimes out of the judgments, we're going to find the character of God. How God's character is shown in judgment, in redemption. And we'll see how that is revealed to the people. Did they believe it? Did they open their hearts? Not all of them. Some did. Some believed. But as a nation, they did not. So, we have this promise. Isaiah is the Word of God. And we'll talk more about that next week. So, Father, we thank you as we yield our hearts.